I dreamt a dream
Hello, my name is Kate Mildenhall. I'm a writer and co-host of the First Time podcast, and I am thrilled to be your host for this podcast series for the Yarra Valley Writers Festival. It's called I Didn't Plan It That Way, and it's conversations about failed ideas, misguided moments, and the books that stayed in the bottom drawer. Over five episodes, I'll talk to five guests of the festival: Meg Mason, Rick Morton, Sally Hepworth, Jesse Tu, and Michael Veitch, about their greatest failures and whether or not they learned anything from them at all. Do join myself, my guests, and the fabulous lineup of writers and thinkers for the Yarra Valley Writers Festival in Warburton this July 16 to 18. Check out our show notes or search for Yarra Valley Writers Festival for tickets.
Lowlands away, my John.
Meg Mason began her career at the Financial Times and the Times of London. Her work has since appeared in the Sunday Times, the Sydney Morning Herald, and the Sunday Telegraph. She's written humour for the New Yorker and Sunday Style, monthly columns for GQ and Inside Out, and is a contributor to Vogue, Elle, Stella, and Marie Claire. Fun fact, in her time, I know this because I did this for another interview, she has interviewed stars such as Joanna Lumley and the Kardashians, and this does not intimidate me at all. Her first book, A Memoir of Motherhood, Say It Again in a Nice Voice, was published in 2012. Her second, a novel, You Be Mother, in 2017. And her most recent novel is, of course, the critically acclaimed and best-selling Sorrow and Bliss, released in 2020. Meg lives in Sydney with her husband and two daughters, and it's such a pleasure to speak with you again, Meg.
Thank you so much. I feel like it's our reunion because you were one of the first podcasters, interviewers who I chatted to, because our books came out, Mother Fault and Sorrow and Bliss, are like paired for all eternity because they came out, within a few days of each other in
September
2020?
They did.
With their coordinating covers by coincidence.
Look, so if we can just arrange for that pairing to go on so that I can also get a fantastic screen deal. And, you know, international rights, that would be amazing. Just amazing. Talk to your people about that if you can, yeah. Meg.
Well, whenever I see them in a bookstore, I like secretly whip out a glue stick and stick them together. You know, like
yes.
How the Harvey Norman catalog goes on the back of a weekend magazine. I stick them together upside down like that. It's working a treat. We're selling
millions.
That.
Millions, millions. Meg, of course, the last time we spoke, it was for Yarra Valley Writers Festival. And it was, in fact, that conversation that we had and your specific reference to the fact that Sorrow and Bliss had previously been a broken book that inspired Brooke Powell, the director of the Yarra Valley Writers Fest, to produce this entire little series where we're talking about.
That's amazing. I feel very honored.
That's it. She wanted to talk to more writers. You and I think when we were talking about it, we're like, wouldn't it just be cool to talk to writers about the books that they had in their bottom drawer and all the times they've failed and stuffed things up. And so here we are speaking to you on
amazing.
That very particular idea. I want to start, because the series is called I Didn't Plan It This Way, to ask you, Meg, if you did, when you were a child, was, you know, best-selling author and mum the plan?
It's so funny. Do you know, I heard once or read once that whatever you're doing at age 11 for pleasure is what you should be doing as an adult, some variation of that, whatever you chose to do in your private moments, age 11. And I was definitely sitting in front of my granny's Red Brother word processor. I don't know if you remember word processors as like the in-between a typewriter and a computer where they had a little screen and you could type a sentence and then you press return and the whole sentence came out at once.
Oh my gosh, amazing.
In a ticker. And I still think about it and feel quite goosebumpy because I loved it so much. And
what were you writing?
Oh, novels, 100% novels. Like some of them were up to 200 words long, you know. But I didn't ever think of it as a job, you know, that's something that you could do as a true job, because strangely for someone who was writing novels, I wasn't reading them at all, ever. And so I didn't have any sense of authors who I admired or, you know, series that had informed me. Like authors are always talking about being that child reading under the covers with a torch. And I'm like, nah.
Not
absolutely
me.
Not. Fast asleep.
Did not happen. Maybe about the novel I'm going to write tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. So I really don't know how that happened, but clearly it was something sort of deeper in my core that meant storytelling was a thing, or I don't know how it really evolved, but certainly not a five-year plan made out of high school or something like that.
Because you went on to be a journalist. Mm-hmm. Was there a point at which you were just compelled to start writing for yourself or to start writing your story? What happened there? What was that moment?
Well, I was working out, I did 1 year as the managing editor at Sunday Magazine, which is part of The Telegraph in Sydney. And I was editing, a part of that job was editing the columnists whose work came in once a week and just giving that a wee tidy up, which hardly needed. And anyway, one of the columnists had just got a book deal and I was like, oh, maybe I should, you know, just write a book, which doesn't that sound ridiculous when you just casually think it, you know, when you're walking to
don't people tell you that all
ladies
the time?
Lose. They've exactly. Got a book in them. So I was that person. Exactly. And you know, they always say, don't they? I've got a little bit of light brain surgery in me, but I just haven't had time to like pursue it. Anyway, brain surgery is actually harder. But anyway, so I just cold called the publisher who had done that book, thinking that I would sound much more highfalutin as, you know, maternity infill, didn't mention that part, just mentioned the managing editor part. And so met with someone and that didn't go anywhere. But then I'd sort of written this sample chapter and I was like, well, now I'll just keep cold calling, because that was the way that I'd got all my freelance work since I moved back from the UK, like finished uni, went to the UK, came back 5 or 6 years later and had never worked here as a journalist. So a lot of cold calling was involved in getting that freelance up and going. So I'm not totally terrified of cold calling. So I just kept going until one publisher said, let's have a coffee. And she liked it. And that was HarperCollins. So in the end, did give me the deal. But to make it not sound really glamorous, the day that she called me out of the blue, was like, I'm in the area. You know, I was in the office. I'm in the area. I'm coming. Let's go and have a coffee. For some reason, I'd been bitten on the forehead by some sort of pest, some sort of mosquito that my having no allergies to mosquitoes at all, my face was like, I'm going to go massive. So I had this enormous, swollen, Klingon type forehead situation happening. And it had been the talk of the office all morning because it was so massive. It was changing the way I looked and changing my profile. Do you know what I mean? And so I ran over to like the beauty desk where the beauty writer sits with piles of makeup samples. And I'm like, make this go away. And she's like, I can't. You're going to have to put green tint foundation on it to make it less red. And so I was literally standing in front of the mirror going, in the ladies' bathroom, do I cut a fringe? Do I just cut a fringe right now? Because I want this book deal so much. I didn't do it in the end. I just walked into coffee and I'm like, hello, my name's Meg. So nice to meet you. This is a mosquito bite, just so that you don't have to stare at it the whole time and be like, what is it? I'm so sorry. I've talked about that for like 25 minutes now, but you can cut all of that.
No, I love it. It's a great opener and indicative of the kind of way in which these things happen to us, which are not planned.
That wasn't planned. The mosquito bite was definitely not planned, but maybe it worked as a wonderful icebreaker.
Absolutely. I want to know just a little bit before we move on about that cold calling, because I think people are so terrified of that. People are so terrified of no, of rejection, you know, of immediate failure before you've even jumped in. So you learned about that over the time. Can you remember any of those utter no's that came at you in those first years of cold calling?
I think it's usually your sort of like, it's actually more the slow bleed of not hearing back or sort of the lukewarm ambivalence from somebody like, oh, this is very interesting. If something comes up, we'll be sure to be in touch. You know, it's that I'll put your CV on file and you're like, okay, see you never. So there was a lot of that, but I think you just have to, well, it helps if you have no other skills, because I only had one thing that I could sell. So I had to just keep selling it until someone bought it. But I think the important thing, and somebody said to me the other day, which was so kind, someone I met at a festival, that she was interested in being a journalist and she had read my bio and there were lots of, you know, she felt great publications on there, which there are, but for every publication on there, there's 10 that's not on there. Do you know what I mean? Like there's a lot of human resources magazine and website copy for accountancy firms and stuff like that, which I don't put on there because it would be quite lengthy to read. You know, Meg Mason is the author of Storm Bliss and used to write copy for very small financial advisory houses. My theory always was, and I've said this before, but my theory always was, if Kate Moss can do Rimmel, I can do Human Resources Magazine. Do you know what I mean? So I think the thing is just to write yourself stupid, because everything you write does make you better, even if it's not something you're interested in. But you just have to do it, because you can't just sit there waiting for someone to ring you up and be like, you have no experience, you've never written, but we've just got a really good feeling about you. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. So, let's talk about your broken book, Sorrow and Bliss, which is ironically and delightfully so successful that you're kind of the pin-up girl in my eyes for writing fails that turn to gold. Why do you say, can you explain to us why Sorrow and Bliss was your broken book?
Yes. So Sorrow and Bliss was written in 2019. 2018 was spent writing a book that that I worked so hard on, and it was so poor. I mean, it was so bad that after a year, when it was just about due, I threw it away and told my, I mean, I sent it to my publisher to show her, but I said, this is unsalvageable. I know it. I'm sure you'll know it. And of course she did know it. And I looked up that email the other day because she and I were sort of having a little reminisce, and it just said it was the saddest, kind of like just wateriest, depressed email I think I must have ever written, because it just said, you know, here is my manuscript. Please don't read it. If you have to read it, there's some paragraphs in chapter 9 that are okay, but it never quite came out. You know, like, this is like hundreds and hundreds of hours work. This is what, like, wasn't me just having a wee dabble and kind of, you know, hoping there might be something there. And I said, I think I'll be relieved when you actually tell me to put it to one side, you know, end of email. And she was so kind, and she wrote back and she said, I'm sure, you know, we can salvage it. But at the same time, I think I hated it so much by then, and she could see the absolute flaws in it, which would have really taken another whole year to fix anyway. But if you fundamentally at your core don't like what you're writing, which I didn't, like, the story was flawed and broken and the characters were not interesting, why would you spend, you know, I couldn't bear to even read it before I sent it to her. So there was no way I wanted to kind of re-enter it. So I scrapped it, and in my head, if not out my mouth to my publisher, I sort of quit. Felt like I couldn't put everyone through that again, because it had been, as well as those awful days around scrapping it, the actual year itself had been quite miserable because I was not enjoying what I was doing. But I think
Were you contracted for this, Meg? Is that why you had hand it over?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, they would have said, she would have said, oh, just don't worry about the deadline, because, you know, deadlines in publishing are not like deadlines in journalism insofar as they're not really real and movable fees. But it was just because I didn't have another idea, and I sort of felt like the one skill, I suppose, that I feel like I have really developed as a journalist is you just do it when it's due. You know what I mean? Like, you can't just ring up and say, it's not happening, you know? So I just pressed on thinking it would come right, and it didn't. But one of the loveliest things about Sorrow and Bliss, and I'll just tangent for a minute, if that's a verb, is that I've met such interesting people in the course of things, and got to interview Claire Chambers, the UK author who's done Small Pleasures. And she's the author of sort of 14 novels or something. And I think Small Pleasures is about number 14, and it's gone absolutely mad. It's doing so well. But that the 13 before it didn't really do as well. And there was sort of a broken book between 13 and 14, which she worked on for 5 years before she realized it was trash. And I mean, she was absolutely at the end, and I thought, oh, wow, 5 years, that only took me 1 year to work it out. Like, do you know what I mean? So I felt quite after it, because I thought I was the only author in the world who would ever have done something so stupid. Or as in not stupid, but sort of self-defeating in terms of pressing on. So I now sort of assume that all authors must have one that they've labored over and, you know,
didn't go anywhere.
Blood and
no.
It didn't go anywhere.
So, I didn't realize we've spoken to Sally Hepworth as well for this series, and she indeed, her broken book was her fifth. I didn't realize that at all. So
yeah, but I think that's it, isn't it? It's not the first one, because I think the first one, you know, if that broke, you would think I can't do this. But when it's two or three or seven, you have done it before. So you sort of think, I should just be able to do it. I have done it before. I'll just keep pushing on and on and on. And that's probably what was misleading about it, that this was the wrong book. It was rotten to the core. And so abandoned it and then just took about 6 weeks. I was 6 weeks into my post-career life with no plans to ever return to it. And then I just remember that that one scene that became the first scene of Sorrow and Bliss came into my head. And I just wanted to write it down, and I did. And then it just sparked something. And so the only things that were brought across from the previous manuscript were some character names and the sort of setting of London. And there were some, there's a vague Christmas thread that runs through Sorrow and Bliss, and that was in there in the first novel, but otherwise, which was actually called Untitled Christmas Novel for the whole time. And so that's what came across, but otherwise it's a completely different book. So no actual paragraphs or text were brought across.
You wrote about the process. You said, although the wasted year was painful, it was necessary. And I wonder if you think that creative projects require some kind of pain to be successful, or do you think that maybe one day you might have a book that is just an utter joy to write? Would that be something that's possible?
Yeah. Well, I think because Sorrow and Bliss was a joy to write, and it once it began, and I had 4 months of writing in secret before I told my publisher I was back at it, or any of my friends or family or anything. And that was a joy to write because nobody was, you know, aware that I was doing it. And so it was just fun. And there seemed to be all this material there, but it was there because I had had a year of pain prior. Do you know what I mean? And when I look back now, even though it felt like such a waste, that was all groundwork and backstory. And I knew these characters, at least their backstories. Well, if not, I hadn't found a voice for them that could carry across, and I hadn't found the story, and there wasn't the mental health element in that first book. So that was all to be done for Sorrow and Bliss. But there was something that I must have been sort of at some psychological deep level working on in the background for all that time, because it sometimes in a novel writing process, you are sitting there workshopping characters, trying to get their voice right for a really long time, but it did all sort of come, but it was only because I think I had had that pain. So, I think it's not necessarily pain, but it is work. You know, I don't think that you can write a novel without really, really putting in a million hours at your desk, either, you know, before, or during, or after, or just generally all the time. So I can't imagine doing it without hard work.
That's interesting, that idea of kind of writing in secret for 4 months, because I think so much of our idea of failing is about how other people are perceiving our failure and the kind of fear that we have of that. So how were you coping when your broken book broke?
Yeah,
Untitled Christmas Novel. How did you cope with that period of kind of like saying, I failed at this? How were you saying that to other people?
Oh, I was full of shame. Like I'm not positing this as like, oh, I'm a doctor who killed someone, or, you know, this is not an important thing that I'm doing. You know, like, this is not something that failing costs anybody except me. You know what I mean? I know that it's not any kind of job on that level, but I had put everybody through the experience with me, everyone in my family and my friends, and all year updating them with how it was going and all of that sort of stuff. And then, you know, people ask you how the book's going, and at a point you have to say, oh, it's not, I gave up. You know what I mean? And it was horrible because I'm not really a quitter. Like, I have many flaws, but quitting isn't one of them. I mean, actually, that is a flaw, isn't it, that I don't quit because I wasted a whole year. It should be a virtue. Anyway, it was awful, and I didn't know what I wanted to do instead. Well, actually, I mean, I didn't want to do anything else instead. And so I sort of, I was really privately devastated. And it's a hard thing to express to anyone, I think, because it probably seems like a hobby, or it seems like, I think people in wanting to reassure you say, oh, well, you can try again, or, you know, you've written another book, you know, you can write another book, or, you know, all of those lovely, kind and well-meaning things, but they're not there to witness the true daily, minutely agony of sitting in front of a screen and looking at what you wrote and knowing it is bad and seeing the extent of your talent and the fact that it does not stretch to what you need it to do and just all of those things, because it is quite emotionally, I mean, a lot of the hard work of it is actually keeping yourself emotionally level while you're doing it and not getting too into the I'm a trash human type talk and all that sort of thing. So yeah, I felt awful. I couldn't stop crying for weeks. Basically, once Untitled Christmas Novel was in the trash.
I'm almost like bleeding at the same time as listening to you, because I can remember at one point at which I got some really kind of brutal feedback on a book that what is written down in my journal is I am going to burn the whole thing and I don't know how I'll ever get up again. You know, so you're right. Well, yes, we're not kind of saving lives, but the feeling is no different in the body about the shame of you failing at something that you thought you were going to do.
And what you've essentially done as a writer when you put something on a page and give it to someone is say, this is the very best I can do and I think it's good. And you're exposing yourself to someone who knows probably better than you do if it's their publisher, saying it's not good and you need to do better. Do you know what I mean? Like, and if you feel that you can't, that you really sat there and cared about every sentence and at no point were you sort of thinking, oh, that's fine, that'll do, just whack that in. Do you know what I mean? If you really were careful, I mean, it is quite hard to just do a bit of a rebound. And I mean, my publisher was amazing about it. She was so kind and actually said all the right things, which all bore out. And I asked her the other day, I said, did you believe me when I said that I quit? And she was like, absolutely not. I knew that you'd be back. And, you know, it was only a matter of weeks after that. So she, I guess, knew me better than I did, that I just really can't stay away from it because it is the thing, isn't it? But for the awfulness of it, the brilliant heights of it are indescribably euphoric and amazing.
In lots of ways, Sorrow and Bliss is about failures of insight and of one's own brain and the way that it can betray you and of marriage and of relationships. What, if anything, has the response to the book, the incredible response to the book, made you understand about what readers want from their protagonists in terms of how flawed they are? And I suppose I'm thinking, like, people adore Martha like they adore Fleabag or Marianne in Normal People, to which your book is often compared. So I suppose it's, what is it that compels us about watching other people fuck up so spectacularly?
Yeah, I think it's really funny because it's been a real, for every person who does love Martha, and I'm obviously in that camp because I find her, as well as being an absolute nightmare, I do believe that she's charismatic and that she's charming and that she's not telling you the full truth about herself. And in terms of the fact that she's not as awful as she makes out, because she's obviously selective in what she tells you in this narration. But for every one of us, Dean Martha, there is someone who says, I wanted to shake her. She was so unlikable. She was so self-sabotaging, so selfish. She was awful to her husband. But I think, just as another tangent, what's been so surprising to me about that reaction, and I get it, like, she is self-involved in all of those things, but the whole book is attempting to explore, where does Martha start and where does the illness start? And which is which? Do you know what I mean? What is her and what is her undiagnosed mental illness? And my argument would be, all of it is her illness. She's been ill since she was 17. She has, when we meet her at 40, never had a diagnosis. So every single decision that she makes is informed on some level by her pain and her lack of knowledge about herself. So it's been a really interesting, I suppose, exposure to the ways in which I think we say that mental illness has been destigmatized, but has it really, in the sense that when we see someone behaving out of it who doesn't have a big badge on their chest saying, I am mentally ill and that's why I just smashed a window, do you know what I mean? Do we just say, oh, that person's so unlikable, they should pull themselves together? Like, that's been really interesting to me. But I think the people that feel sort of that they identify in some way with Martha, or they've just enjoyed her story or felt, you know, responded to it in some way, I think it is because Martha is a character who is consumed by shame for the way that she's behaved for 20 years. You know, this is a 352-page apology that she is telling this story as an apology, because she has finally, and this isn't a spoiler, I don't think. No, it's on the back. She gets a diagnosis. So she can now look over the course of her entire life and she can see what was her and what was the illness. But I think that she, in being so open about telling you the most awful parts of herself, I think there might be something in there where we think, oh, I felt like that, but maybe couldn't tell anyone because it seems so atrocious, you know, the day that I hated my husband or the day that I, you know, hung up on my mother or told her I never want to see her again or whatever it is that Martha's done. I just think there's something that we really don't go around trumpeting our most awful, you know, moment. And so I think there's something in that. And I think beyond that as well, I've had some just amazing, truly amazing emails from readers who identify with her struggle. And Martha's illness isn't named, but the fact that it's not named means that you can sort of, I think, project whatever you like into that, into that space. And so particularly women who felt that they see themselves in her mental illness have sort of said that it articulates something about those most acute moments, that because they're sort of beyond language and beyond describing, I imagine if you experience them in real life, it's very hard to then turn around and say to your husband or sister, oh, that's what I was feeling, that's why I did this. And to, you know, to then sort of frame it, I guess, in words or, you know, in some, as it were, rational kind of way. And so I think the way that there are some sections in the novel where Martha describes exactly what she feels like, maybe you can sort of turn the book around and just point at it and be like, this is how I felt. So I think that's why, I think that's the levels on which people are sort of relating to her.
Because from the other side, the way, one of the quotes that I had written down, and this is partly because this one is shared often about the book online. And I know you stay offline, which is very clever of you on such things. And it's when Martha's cousin Nicola says to her, ideally, Martha, you want to figure out the reason why you keep burning your own house down. And I think from the outside, that's what often people like Martha look like they are doing, just absolutely spectacularly self-sabotaging, you know, wanting to blow shit up all the time.
As though it was a choice though. Like yes, when I did read someone saying, yeah, I wanted to slap her because she did this to her husband. What part of you would choose to behave that way if you could honestly choose? I don't think anyone is as naturally and casually beastly as that without caring. Do you know what I mean? If you are married to this person, you wouldn't treat them that way if you had any agency over your behavior. So I think that's what really surprises me. And of course, you know, it's like with anything, why would you burn that house down in self-sabotage? And yet we all do it, don't we? We all can look back and be like, what was I doing? Like, why did I seem so intent on wrecking my life and blowing things up? And it's also not a singular decision often. It's a series or a pattern of decisions that we make in a series and, you know, a pattern of the way we behave or a dysfunction or a single conversation and like a relationship that we just keep having in 1,000 iterations. But those are the patterns. And I guess they're laid in by family of origin or whatever it is. And they're there. And I think growing older is an exercise in actually getting to the very root of them and working out where they came from and if they can indeed be dug up and sort of we can start to make different decisions about things.
Without projecting onto you.
I'll project away. I'm a blank canvas.
Sorum Bliss has been one of those like breakout kind of successes. You talked before about Small Pleasures and it one of those successes that makes other authors, and I will say, you know, potentially other authors whose book was released on the same day as yours, Meg Mason, green with envy. Your endorsement page on the HarperCollins website just goes like on. It goes on a lot, actually. It starts with Ann Patchett and Gillian Anderson, for God's sake, and then it just like it continues. I had to keep scrolling for quite some time. Anyway, Liz Gilbert in her TED Talk, which is, you know, watched about a bazillion times on success and failure and creativity, talks about how disorienting success is and as problematic in some ways as failure is. So I want to ask you about how you're feeling about your next work and the kind of expectations which might be on you now.
Yeah, it's really strange because it's that Elizabeth Gilbert idea is also the Rudyard Kipling idea, isn't it, about treating success and failure both as imposters.
Absolutely.
I think that, to be honest with you, I feel like it's happening to somebody else, but I'm just really party to all of the details. Do you know what I mean? It's like if I had a best friend who told me everything, because it doesn't relate to me. Like, it's not, when I open Soren Bliss now, I can't see what anybody is talking about. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, as in, I'm like, but which bit do you mean? Because I just see it really more than a book about mental health, as a collection of stupid observations that Martha makes and kind of absurdist. That's honestly the core of it for me, and her and Ingrid and that sort of thing. So I will never be able to tell you why this one struck a chord. You know what I mean? Really, like, at the absolute bottom of it. So I don't feel like it relates to me. And I think when I get those emails in particular, which are, I don't mean far more meaningful than other endorsements and things, because it's all amazing. But I think when someone's really sharing their true daily struggle and real lives, I have nothing to do with what they've got out of the book. Do you know what I mean? I didn't sit down to write something that, you know, there was this mum who wrote to me to say that she now feels differently about the daughter that she's been caring for her whole adult life. And that's not me. Do you know what I mean? That's not something that I could affect just by, you know, I never meant it. And so therefore I can't really take credit for any of that. If that makes sense, that's just something that happened. So I don't, but in terms of, yeah, I think not being on social media is really helpful. And funnily enough, going off it was a decision made right around the time of ending Untitled Christmas Novel, because I didn't have the emotional resource to spend on social media emotions management. And so that was when I bombed all of that.
Interesting, because I just assumed you were one of those people who just didn't do it full stop, had never had.
No, well, I did do it. I don't know why, because I was useless at it. I had a really tiny number of followers, but I felt this, I had this belief that as a freelance journalist, I had to have an online presence, even though it was absolutely so minimal. And then I just realized one day, observed the fact that, I'm only sharing this just because it might be useful for sort of writers who are working at the moment and a bit struggly, is that I had my phone in my office, which is number one stupid thing to do, even if there's no social media on it, because I did also read a study that says it lowers your IQ even if it's in the room. You don't have to be on it. It's just in the room. Your functional IQ goes down. So now I never, ever have it like it's in the glove box or it's somewhere absolutely that I have to stand up and actively walk to go and get it when I'm working. But anyway, what I realized was I would reach for it just as the work got hard, but that's the point that you need to push through, because that's when the deep thinking happens if you stay sitting down. But when you're writing or imagine doing any kind of deep thought work, that's when it gets a bit uncomfortable and you feel like you've hit your limit. You just reach for your phone as that little, I just need a quick dopamine squirt. So I would go on social media and I would be perfectly fine when I picked it up, and then I would be depressed when I put it down. And I think part of the reason as well, apart from just seeing all the writers being like, oh my gosh, you guys, really excited to let you know that I'm just like super successful for these following events and reasons that have happened. Like, why would I put that in my own head? Especially because I knew I was coming to a horrible end while brilliant things were happening to other people, like good on them. But also I felt like I was expending a great deal of creative or mental energy forming relationships with people I didn't know and I would never meet, who were giving me exactly zero thought, but five times a day I would check in to see what they were doing. And then I was just like, what on earth? I don't have the wherewithal to be spending on that. And even though it felt like if another book ever did come out, it would be mad to not be an author online and be able to, like, you know, promote the book or whatever, I just made the decision in the end that if I keep all of that emotion spare, then I can put it into my work and I'll write a better book and then it will sell itself and it will do better than me shilling it to my 482 followers that just went down to 480. So why? What did I say? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, and so that's what I did. And then it was just that contributed to that feeling of not being surveilled, even though I was surveilling myself. Do you know what I mean? I just felt more invisible and I felt like no one knew where I was or what I was doing. And I love that feeling. And so I think that was really significant. And your question was like 20 minutes ago. So what was it again?
I can't even remember, because I think my life just changed entirely with your description of what your phone and social media can do. And I'm rethinking not only my work and my social media presence, but just my entire reason for being.
So just your value.
Yeah.
No, but it's funny as well, because, like, as in, some people are brilliant at it. Some people can manage it and it doesn't have any mental impact on them or whatever. And it's, you know, people run amazing businesses of it. So I don't mean to say Instagram's poison, but I think the other thing as well is just that I think what I see now, because for 3 days I kept picking up my phone and then you just stop picking up your phone because every time you pick it up, you're like, oh, there's nothing actually to do on it apart from like my menstrual tracker, which I've already, do you know what I mean, checked in on. I'm ANZ Go Money, which is never exciting. So anyway, so then you just stop picking it up generally as a rule. And now when I see people on Instagram, I'm genuinely like, oh, people still doing that. Because also that never ends. Like you will never get to the bottom of that feed and you just, it is a job you can never cross off. And I just sort of feel like I crossed it off. So I don't know. I mean,
I think you've changed my life. We'll come back to this at some point. Maybe at Yarra Valley Writers Festival, we'll have a wine and we'll see if I'm posting about it or not. And you'll know. Yeah. The question was, are you scared? Are you scared now because of the success?
I am not, I sort of, yes, I can no longer convince myself no one's going to see what I write or know that I'm writing it. So that sort of feels I'm not sure what it will be. And I started working and it's, you know, absolutely very early on, but Sorrow and Bliss has become a sort of oddly almost like a full-time job at the moment. And I think, obviously it will die down, but just because it's coming out in the UK soon, that's sort of another, you know, that publication process again. So I think that I am a bit nervous, but I've just learned so much from the whole Sorrow and Bliss experience, like when to bail out, you know, what to say and not say, what it should feel like when you're working on it. So even if you don't necessarily like what you've produced today, you should feel a certain imperative or a certain interest or passion to keep going on it. And if it doesn't feel in some way imperative, then it isn't and you should stop. You know what I mean? So I think that there's those lessons which I'll have there. And I think it might be the where I get that sense of privacy back is probably from the fact it's a whole different set of characters and no one knows their names. And I'll just have to sort of parlay that into that same feeling. But yeah, because I have absolutely no assurance that I can do it again. You know, I'm sure that when a doctor does go to do a brain surgery, he is fairly sure that he or she will be able to do that surgery because they did one yesterday and it went brilliantly and they'll just do it again. Whereas we sit down every day not knowing what the job is or whether we can actually do it again because you're making something out of nothing. And so there is that factor, but I have got no excuse not to try. So I'll just keep going to my desk and sitting down and you'll either see another book in 2 years or never hear from me ever again. This is the last time we ever spoke. Like, what happened to her? It's all going so well.
It was finished. All going so utterly well. I'm interested in the idea that there's some failures that you just don't need. You know, that don't make you grow at all, that just are just
those
shit.
Awful, fruitless, pointless agony for no reason.
So are there failures in your own life you just wish you hadn't had, full stop, bang?
Oh, just so many. The needless kind of suffering ones that you learnt nothing. Yeah, so many. And we'd have to make this a three-parter if I was actually going to kind of like enumerate them all. But I think that the trick there is probably to just force some meaning out of them. Do you know what I mean? Like just, even if it's the fact that I might not do that again, or I'll do it differently, because otherwise it is just too painful to sort of think about. But I think it's also really important to truly try and believe that it's not just you, because it, you know, we only see our insides, all of that sort of thing, compared to other people's outsides. And nobody, even those shiniest of all people on social media, and I know we say this all the time, but I don't know if we actually believe that they can have the awfulest day, or they have a really problematic family, or you know what I mean, or they're just depressed for no reason. And I think it's really important to do that, because life does have a great deal of suffering in it, that a lot of it is needless and pointless, you know. And it sounds really grim, but it also has a lot of happiness in it that we don't deserve.
Aside from Untitled Christmas Novel, are there any other failures that you're, you know, bottom drawer ideas that you never saw the light and you're like, damn, I'm so glad I didn't bring that one out?
No, but there is my first book, which I wish I could either unwrite it or rewrite it, because
your first book that's just been beautifully repackaged and re-released.
Yeah, and it looks heavenly. And but I think there should be a sticker on the front of it.
I want to say right now, just be very careful about what you're going to say, because I'm going to get a phone call from your publicist saying, why did you let Meg like rag out her own book?
Oh, no. Well, this is the thing. I can't observe it. I can't see it neutrally. Do you know what I mean? But I think what I learned from that book, and the reason why there are vast sections of it that I would love to be able to scribble out with a pen every time I go into a bookstore, is that, you know how they say, don't drive angry, don't write angry either. And this was a memoir written by a 30, whatever I was, mother of two small children, who didn't have any help or any money and worked at night, you know, to do whatever, pay daycare. And I was exhausted and probably like postnatally depressed, if you can still be postnatally depressed when the child is like three. And so when I picked up that book for the very first time, like maybe 6 weeks ago, since it came out 10 years ago, I was so horrified to see this person that I was, who was so blithe and sarcastic and mean and was trying to separate herself and be on the outer all the time. And just, I just didn't recognize that person. And strangely though, I do still get emails from people saying things like, oh, that kind of helped me keep going. Or, you know, that made me feel like I wasn't the worst mother in the world, which is lovely. But I genuinely think there should be a sticker on that book that says, unless you have postnatal depression, do not read this, because it is dark. And this woman is a massive cow and really unhappy, visibly very unhappy, and it doesn't excuse it, and it hasn't aged well just in terms of shifting social mores. So I find that really difficult, and I wish I could undo it, but I can't. And so it just lives on in perpetuity to be a sort of, look how far I've come, please forgive me.
If readers do go in and find a copy of Meg's first novel, which is Say It Again in a Nice Voice, sorry, her memoir, with the pages scribbled out, I'm pretty sure that's going to get you some money on eBay eventually. So just like, yeah, maybe you do want to actually find those copies.
And I was like, I can't go around and buy them all up myself to get them off the market, because that will make it seem like it's doing really well and they'll keep reprinting them. So I would have to shoplift them, which I would never do to booksellers, because that's the only way I could get it off the shelves, is to shoplift every single copy in existence. So yeah, I think it has its own life and its own readers. But for me personally, it was a big learning curve in terms of, be careful what you write about, be careful how you write about your children. That is probably the biggest learning that I would just desperately want to impress on anyone, men or women. But I think mothers especially, we can write about, I mean, not necessarily in books, but just on social, or, you know, it's hard when your children are that young to understand that they will be sentient one day, and that those stories that you're writing are actually not yours, they're theirs. And none of this will ever go away. So whatever you're writing about them, this is, you're telling their story and their stories, and you're also creating a narrative around them, which they will, you know, absorb into themselves. So it's there's things that I would just do so differently with 10 years of extra wisdom on top of that.
Well, we are very glad you've done the things that you do. Martha's mother, Celia, the amazing sculptor in Sorrow and Bliss, says, I know you and your sister tease me for the repurposing, but all I've been trying to do all these years is to take rubbish and turn it into something beautiful and much stronger than it ever was before. And Meg Mathan, on behalf of all of your readers and our audience on the podcast and the fans who no doubt will turn up and mob you at Yarra Valley Writers Festival, thank you for taking your broken book and turning it into something beautiful and much stronger than it was, because it's an absolute delight to read and it's an absolute delight to speak to you.
Thank you so much. One of Celia's children does actually accuse her of ignoring them while she makes shit out of forks because she repurposes metal objects. So you could also cast it the other way and be like, thank you for making shit out of forks.
That's it. That's the line. Works. Thank you for making shit out of forks, Meg Mason.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually my next book title, I think. But thank you. It's been such a pleasure to chat. I just am such a fan, and I'm so excited to come to Yarra, where I've never been before. And so I'm really looking forward to it. And thank
it's
you to
really
everyone
lovely.
Who's read the book. Thank you.
Lowlands away, my John.
Thank you, Kate. I'm Brooke Powell, Festival Director, and I'm so very pleased you joined us. This year's Yarra Valley Writers Festival is calling the township of Warburton its home over the weekend of July 16 to 18, 2021. There will be writerly sessions, walks in nature, and dinners in extraordinary rooms. We have also curated virtual sessions to be made available to those that can't make it to the beautiful Yarra Valley. We've done this as it's important to us that we stay in touch with all of you after such a strange and tumultuous time. The Yarra Valley Writers Festival thanks all of its supporters, its collaborators, and its friends that buy tickets. We need you, and we do love you. We also hope to share a long and story-filled life with all of you. With that, we pay respects to some of the greatest storytellers of all time, and we respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners, the Wurundjeri people, as the custodians of this land. We pay respect to all Aboriginal community elders, past, present, and future, who have resided in the area and have been an integral part of the history of this region. If you're after tickets, more information on our program, or simply would like to send us an email, please head to our website, yarravalleywritersfestival.com.
Yarra Valley Writers Festival is funded by Creative Victoria and Yarra Rangers Tourism, supported by Yarra Rangers Council and Verso Books. The music accompanying this episode is Lowlands Away by Thomas Veitch and Rose Hampton from the Hellship soundtrack. Audio production by Phoebe Adie.